WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Miriam Makeba was the first South African singer to become an international celebrity. But once she got out of South Africa in 1959, she was never allowed back in. Although she thought of herself as shy when she wasn't singing, she became a spokesperson for the rights of blacks in her country. Makeba has lived in Guinea for close to 20 years. She returned to America last year to perform with Paul Simon's Graceland tour. Now she's back again with a new record and a new autobiography. In the autobiography, she tells about the indignities she suffered in South Africa when she started performing, about how Harry Belafonte took her under his wing in America, about her marriages to a black South African policeman, to musician Hugh Masekela, to activist Stokely Carmichael, and to an African Muslim. And she writes about surviving cancer. I spoke with Miriam Makeba from the NPR Bureau in New York. Before we hear from her, let's listen to a song from her new album, Sangoma. Miriam Makeba, I want to welcome you to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
On your new record, are all those songs that you learned during your childhood?
Most of them, yes.
They're beautiful songs.
Thank you. Most of them are songs that are sung during ceremonies of traditional healing by our traditional healers, whom people out here in the West call witch doctors, but I don't agree with that because I feel you can't be a witch and a doctor at the same time. So you're either one or the two. So for us, they are doctors like any other medical person. But we call them Sangoma, and that is why the album was called Sangoma, because most of the songs come from the songs that are sung by these people.
Well, your mother was a Sangoma.
Yes, she was one of them, yes.
How did she know that she had that?
There are things that happen to you time and time again, and then those who have had the experience before will notice and let you know, and then you have to go and develop that whatever inner power, gift of having that inner power. You have to go and develop. It's like going to school, so you have to go and study with those who studied it before you to be able to know how to bring it out and see what happens to people and be able to know how you can cure someone from an ailment and so on and so forth. It's rather hard for me to explain because I'm not so perfect in English. There are some words that I want to say, they come out in Xhosa in my mind, but I can't translate them into English.
You've been living in Guinea for the past 20 years. Which language have you been speaking there mostly?
French. I've been in Guinea 18 years, but they speak French, and I had to learn French because before going to Guinea, I didn't speak French at all. But now I get by.
Do you speak your original language much?
No, not in Guinea. In West Africa is completely different from the southern part of Africa. the languages are different, and even the colonizers had different languages, French and English.
You know, listening to your record and reading your book made me think about how, when I heard you in the past, I really knew nothing about your life. I knew nothing about what an extraordinary life you had. I mean, you were arrested when you were 18 days old with your mother.
Yes. Yes. And she always said, you know, once arrested, you may have to go 3 times. And I went many more times, up until even in Europe. I was arrested once in Denmark. And I said, I guess she didn't lie to me.
When you started singing and performing in South Africa, did that give you any special privileges? You were touring with different groups.
No. I said again that I was arrested many times after I was a baby. Because whether you are a singer, well-known or not, if you're black, you're black. And whenever we came from shows, we would be required to have what they call a pass, a night pass, to be in the city after 11 o'clock at night, which was the time for curfew time. And if you're there and you don't have the night pass to produce, you go to jail. And you're lucky if you're arrested during the week, because if it's a Friday, then there goes your weekend, because Saturday and Sunday there's no court. You have to go to court only on Monday.
You came to America through a movie that you were in. It was a documentary movie that you were featured in, and it was received very well. And that's what brought you first to America. One of the first things that happened is that people were very interested in you in the press and on television, and you were invited onto the Steve Allen Show. You had never seen television before, right?
No, because at that time, South Africa had not decided to have television. They were discussing it all the time, and they did not want television. So the decision to have television came long after I had left home. Because they did not want television for quite a long time, saying that it will bring shows that maybe will be of a bad influence to the natives and so on and so forth. So I saw television for the first time in England, which was my first stop when I left home. And then, of course, when I came here, I appeared on it. I did also just one song in England for the BBC. That was the day after Sputnik landed behind the moon, on the back of the moon. And they asked me to sing a song from a show I did at home called Back of the Moon.
You know, it's interesting. You write in your book that your song Pato Pato, which was the big hit in America, was, in your mind, your most insignificant song.
Yes, it was a big hit at home, too, 10 years before that, 1956. And then I did it again here, and it became a hit. But it's a song that really didn't have any deep meaning, because it talked about a dance fad. And that dance was called pata pata, which means touch, touch. And when dancing that dance, you touch each other anywhere your hands can get while dancing. So I was surprised that those songs I felt were meaningful to me never made it but pata pata.
When you came to America, you weren't expecting to be banned from returning to South Africa.
No.
How did you find out you were exiled?
When I wanted to return home, my passport was stamped invalid. But then I had given interviews and telling the truth of how we live at home, and then the film Come Back Africa was not very well received by the South African regime. So it was a combination of many things, and I was not allowed back then. And then I spoke at the UN 2 years later, and it's then that they announced officially, even at home, that I was a persona non grata.
You had avoided political issues when you first came to America to try to protect your family that was in South Africa. What made you decide to start speaking out about South Africa?
I wasn't avoiding. I mean, I don't think that I decided to speak politics as such. Because when I first came here, people were very curious to know where I come from, how we are there, and so on. And all I did was say the truth. I couldn't say I was living in Parktown when I was living in Mofolo, which is a part of Soweto. And those are the things that got me into trouble. Because to the South African government, I was talking politics. But to me, I was talking the truth. And since I decided I cannot lie about the way we live, I've always said the truth, and my truth becomes political, and that's something I can't help. But then I was banned for my participation in the film and for saying that which is true. So I just continued to tell the truth. And people say I'm political. Well, if I am, I'm sorry, but I can't say that we are voting in South Africa because we black people can't vote. I can't say that we are free because we are not free. And I can't say there are no children in prison today in South Africa being tortured because, like the Reverend Busak confirmed to us, there's about 40% of the people in jail are children under the ages of 18. So all of those things are things that are very true and honest that I say. But they say I speak politics. Then let it be.
Miriam Makeba is my guest, and she has both a new recording and a new autobiography. The new autobiography is called Makeba. We're going to talk more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Miriam Makeba is my guest. I'd like to play a little bit from your new album, and this is a song that you describe as a song about exile. You say on the album that it's one of your favorites. Can you say a little bit about it, and then we'll hear some?
It's not really so much about exile as it is a song that says, why me? I'm always so conspicuous as like a leopard among black cats or other types of cats. I'm always the one that is picked on. And in a wider sense, I see it as, why black people? Because you go to any part of the world, black people are always at the bottom of the ladder. In South Africa, we are the majority, and yet we have no rights within our own country. In this country, it's a minority, but still the same kind of treatment. You go anywhere in the world, we are, even among third world people, we are always at the bottom. So we are that spotted leopard. Why? That's what the song is about.
I want to play a little bit of it. Ginkamabala. part of Miriam Makeba's new album, Sangoma. Miriam Makeba is my guest. That's really such a beautiful record. You know, you were telling us before about getting exiled from South Africa. Something interesting happened. You were married for about 10 years to Stokely Carmichael, and when you started seeing him, everybody who had you engaged for a club performance or for a concert started backing out because he was a radical. Were you prepared for that?
I was not. I saw a man I liked who liked me, and I married him. I did not calculate. I was not thinking about any of those things, but I married him, and it happened. And when it happened, I said to myself, well, do I stay here and drown, or do I swim out? So I decided to swim out, and I went to do a tour in Europe for 3 months, and then I went home to Guinea, my second home. I went to make a home in Guinea, and I've been there for the past 18 years. I just said, I'll wait. I've been working in Europe, in Asia, and different parts of the world, except in the United States and Britain. These are the two countries where I had nobody asking me to come and perform or anything. But I waited, and here I am talking to you today, and I'm happy about that, because I believe those who said good things come to those who wait. I hope that those people who then took my personal life so personal have had a change of heart.
So things have changed for you in America.
I hope so. That's what I'm saying. I said, I hope this time I will find that they've had time to think about it, and maybe they've changed their minds. If not, too bad.
You're still living in Guinea.
Yes.
Now, you were very close to the president there, President Touré.
I was close to everybody in Guinea. I still am. The thing is that when I went to Guinea, he was head of state. He received me and protected me in his country. His family became my family. He was like a brother, a father, a friend to me. And the people of Guinea were very kind to me. They still are, because the president died in 1984. And I'm still in Guinea, and I still live among those people, and they haven't done anything bad to me, and I'm still with them.
Because you were so close to the president, he had offered once to find you a husband. He offered you one of his ministers. Why was he so anxious to get you matched up? And how did you interpret that?
Because in Africa, a woman of my age is not supposed to live a single life. I mean, and as a father, like I said, he played the role of father, big brother, friend to me. He said, you know, in our culture here, and you know it's an African custom, you shouldn't be alone. You're not a young girl anymore. You should. I said, who's going to marry me? He said, well, you can choose among my ministers. And I laughed, you know. But
are you married now?
Yeah, I'm still married to my fifth husband.
Well, let me ask you, I know the first time you were married, you were very young. And
yeah, nobody told me to marry then, unfortunately. I got myself into trouble.
Well, you were,
like I explain in one of my songs from Sangoma, which is says, no say shayi lusengagail, where it's like a warning to young women and men that if you indulge in those things before marriage, you're getting yourself into hot water.
Well, you were pregnant when you were 17.
I was pregnant at 17, that's true.
And then your daughter was pregnant when she was 17.
And I cried and cried and cried. And then I thought about myself. I said, what am I crying for? I did the same thing, but I had forgotten. And my mother used to tell me, what you do to me, you will see. You will get the same thing.
I should mention that you discuss in your book something that probably a lot of your listeners didn't know, which is that your daughter died a few years ago after being in labor and after her baby was stillborn. You say in your book that part of what keeps you singing is the desire to avenge the death of your daughter because you thought that in part living in exile was responsible for her death. Do you still feel that way?
I didn't really want it to sound that way. What I said is that it was painful for me to be in exile and lose my child because at home I would have had the support of my aunts, my grandmothers, my grand-aunts, my cousins, and the whole family, because we have an extended family in Africa. You're not alone, but here I was alone and away from the people who even know what to do within our culture when somebody dies. And I felt sad that I was in exile when such a thing happened to me. In fact, many of the things that happened to me, because I never chose to be in exile. If I had been in self-imposed exile, but I was told that I can't go home, and that is painful.
Would you go back to South Africa if you could?
Not now, no. If I went back to South Africa now, I'd really be glorifying apartheid because they would say, ha, 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 you see, even she came back. So that means we're good guys. I will go home, but I'll go home to a free and democratic South Africa.
When friends of yours who are performers ask you if they should perform in South Africa, even if it's just for black audiences, if there's no whites there, what do you tell them?
Well, I had to follow the resolution of the UN because I was here before that resolution. And people were going to perform in South Africa, even though I couldn't go there. I never really thought anything about it until the nations of the world decided that there should be a cultural boycott. I know that many artists would come to me and ask me, I'm asked to go to sing in South Africa, and some people tell me I shouldn't go. I used to explain to them that there is this decision that has been taken by the Special Committee Against Apartheid and the nations of the world that South Africa must be starved of good things because they have a policy of segregation and so on and so forth. And I'd explain it that way to them. And some would listen and some wouldn't. They would just go. And most of the people who asked me would want to know what it's like in South Africa and why this came about. And I take time to explain to them. There are very few who went after I talked to them.
What about Paul Simon? Did you approve of his going there?
I didn't even know he was there until when we were doing the show, and he was being questioned about all his having been to South Africa, and he had a press conference in England where he explained that he did not perform in South Africa. Yes, he went, but he didn't perform there. And to me, that was satisfactory. And there was also some very positive sides of his having been to South Africa in that he went and met musicians at home and brought them here to give them a vehicle on stage in the world, because his tour went all around the world. And this was like an opportunity that some of the artists who had come from home would never have had. Masekela and I had been out here, and there are very few places we went to during the tour that I had never been to. it was wonderful to go back to those places with a show like Paul's show, which was a very beautiful show. And it was great for me to perform with South Africans who had just come from home. It was wonderful being with them because I hadn't been home for 27 years. And just to perform with some of the children that were not even born when I left home was a beautiful thing for me. And even though his show was criticized and all, I mean, there was all this turmoil about South Africa, him having gone to South Africa, I think that those people who came to see the Graceland show cannot honestly say that there were no positive things said or sung against apartheid in that show. I can't talk to those people who did not see the show. So to me, I was again given the chance to be on stage and another thing to come back to this country to continue to say what I was saying before I left here. And like I'm saying it to you now, because I had not performed here in a long time when I came back with Paul Simon.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your life and your music. Thank you for being with us.
I thank you.
My guest has been Miriam Makeba, and she has written an autobiography, which is called Makeba, and she also has a new record that's released in America. It's called Sangoma, and it's on Warner Records. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.